Yesterday, Thursday the 23rd of January, is one of those days that there's just too much of, too much erosion with against other human beings, too many appointments, too much to do, always that sense of being behind, and then played against the backdrop of the unpleasant newspaper stories about Bobby Baker's gift of stereo set to us, about the purchase of life insurance by my company, KTBC, from somebody named Don Reynolds. Ugly things that made a black day. The morning began at 10 o'clock with a meeting which was supposed to include about five of us, but which finally wound up with only Bill Walton, Liz, and I to discuss art. So after about an hour and a half's preliminary going over the file, we decided to call it off and meet again another day, which gave me then a chance to tackle the mountain that is my desk these days, that tyrant that sits there and glowers at me, and also to go over with Bess and Liz the things that I thought had not gone too well with the luncheon for Mrs. Pearson and how to make amends on them in the future. Then at 2 o'clock, I had a meeting with Cliff Carter, Liz, Bess, Kilduff, standing in for Salinger, and we tried to make some decisions on my own future schedules, what things to accept, what we could afford to do without. It varied as far as from having a reception for young college editors here in the East Room in early February, and then a later big one for the American Society of Newspaper Editors when they have their annual meeting in April, to how many of the fundraising dinners with Linda and I should make it a point to go to. Visits to Kentucky, Michigan, New York, for me, were discussed, weighed, most of them decided on. I kept on repeating that I wanted to go somewhere into the South, possibly to Georgia or to Alabama, on something like, having to do with the ARA or the HEW or the Accelerated Works Program or some college thing, with no illusions whatever about what good I can do for it, but maybe that I can center some public interest on the accomplishments of those things. And furthermore, because I'm tired of everybody's acting like the South is a stepchild. I belong to it, and it to me, and I intend to say so even if I get a rebuff for it. I joined Lyndon to go with him to the Sulgrave Club, where all the newspaper women in town, 400, so they thought, but I bet if the fire marshal had really known how many were there, he would have really had a fit, were doing honor to Liz Carpenter. I had intended to go all along. I certainly wouldn't miss a party for Liz, but Lennon's appearance was a last-minute surprise, and I think pretty much threw the place into a swivel. He said a few kind words of his appreciation about Liz, which dear Lord knows she certainly merits, and among them said when he looked around and saw how many friends she had, and thought about the position of women these days, he thought maybe you better consider her as a candidate for the vice presidency. Then I rushed home in time to be here to receive the first of the senators who are arriving at 7 o'clock for another one of those evenings of briefing and dinner. It was informal, business suit, about 63 folks. Kermit Gordon was on hand to tell him about the budget, Senator McNamara, about the Department of Defense, Secretary of State Rusk, to tell them about the state of the world, and someone from CIA to stand in for Mr. McCone. We met in the Blue Room and got off to what I thought was just a very easy gala start. It was fun to see my old friends, Bethine Church and Grace Dodd, Coy Stennis and Ivo Sparkman and Evie Symington. One of the nicest things of all was to see that Senator Russell Long's wife was there with him. She's almost always down in Louisiana, and I hate to think of him being up here alone. As soon as we were all gathered and had glass in hand, Lyndon announced that this was a part business, part pleasure deal, and in true Round Mountain fashion, the ladies and the gentlemen parted company, the men to go for their briefing, and I asked the ladies if they liked to go upstairs and see what their living quarters were like on the second floor, just as we had done in the other party for the Senate a week or so ago. We went up, had the usual tour, and it really was, it gave me a very pleasant feeling when I'd hear an old-timer, one who came here along with us in 1937, Ivo Sparkman, say that she hadn't ever been upstairs before. And to see how much they all did seem to enjoy looking at the very lovely public rooms and then the part of the house that is our very own. In the midst of it all, in bubbled Linda Bird, fresh arrived from the university, hair all done, sparkling, just everything I could want her to be. There's hardly anybody I could introduce her to because she knows them all better than I do. A little past 8, we joined the men downstairs for dinner in the state dining room at Round Tables. Senator Tom Dodd was on my right, and he had some interesting things to say about Claire Booth Luce, who will be in town on Sunday. Gail McGee was on my left, and I couldn't ever ask for better company. Not surprisingly, the menu was chicken, and that being the least expensive thing to have, and the wine was one, but one wine is enough for anybody. The intricacies of the tax bill today are more than I can keep up with. They defeat, victory, defeat, victory, in and out, like a cattle in a chute. I really just don't know how Lyndon can reach a moment of peace at the end of the day, but you couldn't have told it on him. He looked relaxed, happy, successful, even after what must have been a rather grueling press conference. He sent me one of those messages which I always receive with a slight cringing, asking me to get up and say a few words about Maggie, Senator Warren Magnuson, who came to the, well, we are fellow members of about the vintage of 1937. And he, the oldest ranking Democrat there, I believe, and he in turn was going to say something about Senator Ruska. It was easy to reminisce about our years together, Maggie's and ours, and I was really very proud of Lyndon's fine and accurate statement about a member of the opposite party. He was all the good adjectives Lyndon applied to him. And then the surprise of the evening was when Linda Bird got up at her father's prodding and said she had come from the university where they had the number one team of the nation to the house where she could listen to the number one people of the nation and a few more pleasant little things, just as poised as you please. And then we went into the East Room, had coffee, the band struck up, we started dancing. I found myself having fun dancing with Stu Symington, which ended all too quickly. Passed on to at least a dozen or so others, and then gradually folks began to drift away, ending at a very early hour of about 10:30, which is nice enough considering that you arrive back in your bedroom to find the old giant still there, all the mail waiting to be signed. And then I am keeping up with my promise to myself to have these exercises at least 3 times a week so that maybe after about 6 months I might be a little more fit human being. and finally, at long last, about 1 o'clock to sleep.